The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
In the Deathlands, the prevailing philosophy is survival of the fittest.
The muties have broken through!
Send them to hell!
But even among the carnage, perhaps one can find salvation.
I've been saved, Ryan!
What the hell are you talking about, Abe?
Saved by God! By traitor!
But Abe, traitor's dead.
Or possibly an escape.
So, Doc, you're saying if we use this machine, we can get back to our times?
Yes, dear Michael. You can go back to your monastery before Skydark, and I can return to my beloved Emily forever.
May God bless this venture.
But a bloodthirsty group of mutant Amazons may have found their salvation in none other than Christy Roth.
You are our goddess, our savior. You're to take us to the promised land. Don't fight us, or the boy rides the last train west.
My friends will stop you.
Your friends are already dead.
Oh, Gaia.
And now, who will save Christy? Deathlands number 17, Fury's Pilgrims.
Moscow, Russia.
I see our man. He's about to make a move for it.
Take him down.
The Stony Man Commandos, aided by Mac Bolan, are on a vital mission in Russia. Their job is to ensure that a fair and democratic election for the new leader of Russia takes place. But somebody has been targeting the candidates for assassination. It's up to Stony Man to find out who and terminate him.
Who has been interfering with my plans?
We have word from the Ministry. We know where they are going to strike next.
But the operatives of Stony Man are about to find out just how high the conspiracy goes.
Get down!
We can't face down a tank battalion.
We don't have much choice.
Kill them all!
Who's up for a little payback?
You know me. Let's get to work.
At Stony Man Farm, Buck Green has chosen the newest addition to the black suits. James T. Gordon, a U.S. Marshal for 10 years, has been selected for the position.
Welcome aboard, Mr. Gordon.
I've been waiting for this all my life.
James T. Gordon is a Soviet sleeper. Treachery abroad threatens peace in Russia, and deceit at home threatens the base itself. Listen to the conspiracy unfold only in graphic audio. Stony Man number 40, Betrayal.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terrence Azelford, with performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Casey Jones, Dolores King-Williams, and Mort Shelby. Outlanders number 2, Destiny Run.
She came awake slowly. First, the black void turned to gray,
then to a pale, shimmering yellow. A cloying pain enwrapped her, pounding at her head rhythmically in cadence with her heartbeat. She tried to open her eyes, but she couldn't see anything, and she wondered, rather aloofly, if she was blind. For a reason she could not understand, something sticky and thick sealed her eyes shut. Experimentally, she touched the tip of her tongue to her lips, and she tasted a coppery, salty tang. Her stumbling thoughts groped for what it might be. Finally, she realized it was blood, and considering the sharp pain in her head, she knew it had to be her blood. Bridget Baptiste ground her teeth and tried to move. Cramping needles of agony shot up her shoulders and arms. A persistent pressure compressed her wrists, squeezed them so tightly her hands were no more than numb, half-remembered appendages at the ends of her arms. By a tentative exploration with her fingertips, she felt strands of rawhide wrapped tightly around her wrists. She was helpless, blind, and sick. Nausea was a clawed animal trying to tear its way out of her stomach. It was all she could do to swallow the column of burning bile working its way up her throat. Bridget tested her legs, shifting them slightly. They were not bound, though they were stiff, and she realized they had been crooked in an unnatural position beneath her. She didn't brace herself with them. Even though her thoughts moved like half-frozen mud, she knew it was best to keep as silent and as motionless as possible. Through her eyelids, she saw a wavering yellow-red glow, and over the reek of wood smoke, she smelled mutton boiling. She squeezed her left eyelid as though she were squinting fiercely, and a tear formed. By arching her eyebrows as high as she could, she tried to pry her eyes open. The effort sparked more pain in her head, along her right temple. She kept up the squinting and eyebrow arching, and fluid oozed from the duct in her left eye. The tears slowly dissolved the dried blood, and on her 10th attempt, her upper eyelid peeled stickily away from the lower. Flames danced from the bonfire several yards away. Men and women sat around it in a great circle. The wild horde from the mountain valleys of Khalzan sat with the barely leashed eagerness of great cats, waiting for their prey to move so they could start their cruel game all over again. Bridget realized she was in the same place, the same position, before she had fallen into the pit of unconsciousness. Long spears had been driven deep and lashed together to make a crude framework, and from this frame she hung, wrists tied to the wooden shafts by leather thongs. Two other makeshift scaffolds stood close by. Adrian and Davis hung limply between them, ragged red scarecrows. Part of the regular staff of Cerberus Redoubt, they had taken the Mattrans jump with her on their information-gathering mission. They had been scourged without mercy, and the ground around them glistened damp and bloody. Bautu had wielded the lash, and Bridget remembered watching him cut both of his victims with great care, the tapered steel tip of the long, oiled whip singing and flaying the skin like a flexible flensing knife. When the scourging of the men had begun, she had cried out in anger, flinging an insult in the Kalka tongue. She had been surprised that Bautu understood her. She recalled only a fragment of what came next, a leather-shod fist decorated with wafers of polished steel driving toward her head. She had never been knocked unconscious before, so she methodically reviewed what she knew about head trauma induced by a blow. A severe impact on the skull, she told herself, could cause not only a concussion, but also coma, subdural leakages of blood, amnesia, a reduction of intelligence, and death. Aside from coma, she wasn't sure if she was suffering from any of those conditions, except for the amnesia. She still retained a fairly good, if somewhat hazy, idea of who she was, and of the vicious bastard who had rendered her senseless. Bautu paid no attention to her now. He had stripped off his armor, and his broad chest lifted and fell as he drank in great lungfuls of the chill air. The firelight gleamed dully from his thick, greased braids, and despite the cold, a sheen of sweat glistened on the shaved patch at the top of his head. Etched onto the right side of his broad, low forehead was a small marking she couldn't identify. It didn't look like a scar or a tattoo or even a caste mark, yet it somehow resembled all three. Bautu's gloved right fist held the coiled whip, and with his left, he sipped from a bowl of kumis, fermented mare's milk. Even at a distance of 6 yards, she could smell his unwashed animal odor. Bridget kept her head bowed, the fall of her thick red-gold hair concealing most of her face. Through her slitted eye, she gazed through the screen of her hair and beyond Bautu and the bonfire. The camp of the warrior horde spread out across the shallow valley for at least an eighth of a mile. The humped yurts, dome-like tents of stretched yak hide, were scattered in no particular order from one end of the valley to the next. The area between the clumps of yurts was cluttered with two-wheeled carts, ox yokes, hobbled ponies, and mutton racks. Here and there glowed cook fires. Farther out, oxen, horses, and sheep grazed on the scrubby grass growing through the crust of old snow. Beyond the animals lay the black city of Karokoto. Most of the people clustered around the bonfire were men. They were, by and large, warriors, and so dressed accordingly. They were husky, their short legs bowed from years of clutching the barrels of their ponies. They wore yak-skin hauberks and conical fur-lined caps of discolored leather. Though a few shouldered single-shot muzzle loaders, the standard weapon seemed to be a horn-and-wood bow. Every swarthy face had a sparse mustache or beard. Although they'd come following up on rumors of a warlord, Brigid, Adrian, and Davis hadn't expected to find anyone, much less a horde of warriors, at that location. On foot and underarmed, they had been easily captured by Bautu and a mounted scouting party. Brigid understood a smattering of Kalka, but almost nothing of their particular dialect, which sounded like a corrupted blend of Chinese, Turkic, and colloquial Russian. Therefore, she had been unable to provide satisfactory answers to Bautu's shouted questions. Once in the shallow valley, Davis and Adrian had been strung up and scourged. Brigid assumed that after Bautu caught his second wind and had his fill of kumis, she would be next to taste the lash. As soon as the thought registered, Bautu glanced toward her. She didn't move, body slack and sagging, head lolling. He wiped the sweat from his face and took a step forward. Then he froze, head and eyes lifting, gazing past her. Brigid remained motionless. Headlights washed over Bautu. He narrowed his eyes and shifted his position as a flatbed truck jounced over the uneven ground and braked to a stop near the bonfire. Wooden crates, at least a dozen of them, were stacked on the wag's bed, kept in place by hemp netting. Painted on several of the crates in Russian Cyrillic script was a simple legend, 12. Only one man climbed out of the cab. He was tall, at least a head and a half taller than Bautu. The high fleece cap, perched at a jaunty angle, made him seem taller. A silver disc, pinned to the front of the cap, glinted with red highlights. Pulling his calf-length tan trench coat tighter around him, the man gave the hanging figures a disinterested glance and approached Bautu.
Aliba barika buyu.
Ese! Aliba magu buyu!
With a savage sweep of his left arm, Bautu gestured to the bodies of the hanging men.
Ta aibula! Dyson dur dag haruldur! Sabahada niduki sipsi gorda!
The tall man listened to Bautu politely, hands tucked into the pockets of his coat. He nodded, as if in sympathy, then turned away, eyeing first Adrian and then Davis. Hands still in his pockets, he stepped to a hide-wrapped bundle on the ground, very near the fire. He towed a flap aside and gazed expressionlessly at the items piled within it. A compass, three H&K VP-70 hand blasters, wrist crons, a small rad counter, plastic containers of water and concentrated food, and the transcom unit. The little black rectangle of molded plastic and pressed metal held his attention for a very long time. Lifting his head, the tall man gazed toward Brigid. Four long strides brought him right in front of her. She closed her eye and breathed shallowly. A gloved hand cupped her chin, raising her head with a surprisingly gentle touch, and he parted her tangle of hair. She did not move, did not react.
Minomorosh meni golovu.
Brigid understood this language. In Russian, he had said, "Don't fuck with me." Brigid got her feet under her and stood up. Once she was relieved of the strain of supporting her weight, the fierce pain in her wrists and shoulders began to seep away. The man saw she could open only one eye, and he took a handkerchief from a coat pocket. Wetting it with his tongue, he carefully dabbed at the caked blood on her face, then pried up her right eyelid with a thumb and forefinger.
Spasiba.
Quite welcome.
Brigid was taken aback by the man's command of English, and it showed.
Your accent gives you away. You're not Russian. Where are you from?
From far away.
England. No, not England. Your teeth are too good. America. I have never met an American before.
Then we're even. I've never met a Russian. I certainly didn't expect to meet one in Mongolia.
The man smiled. Bridget realized he was older than he looked at first glance. His dark eyes were surrounded by crinkled laugh lines, and the weather-beaten skin on either side of his sharp nose was creased by deep lines. He crossed the index and middle fingers of his right hand.
The histories of Mongolia and Mother Russia have been intertwined for over 1,000 years, since the days of Temujin, Timur, and Babur the Tiger. Sometimes we're enemies, sometimes we're so fond of each other it would give the shade of Stalin the colic.
Which is it now?
Fairly obvious, is it not? You're the one hung up for flaying, not me.
Who are you?
Sverdlovsk is my name. And you are?
Bridget considered giving him a false name, but decided not to bother. Her own name wouldn't make any difference out here. Besides, the pain in her head limited her powers of invention.
Baptiste.
An American in Mongolia. Your comrades were American too, I presume. Sent by one of the Berenice to spy on the Tushegun.
You're making a lot of assumptions.
Hardly. I doubt there's been an American this close to the Black Gobi in 2 centuries. I've heard that the intelligence-gathering networks of the American Berenice were extending into other countries. You and your comrades are proof of that.
Bautu impatiently shook the coiled whip at them.
Baija!
Sverdlovsk returned his attention to Bridget.
A poor excuse for language, I must admit. Probably it was a form of local trading dialect centuries ago.
Probably. After the nuke cost, when communications were cut off with other countries, these people slipped back into barbarism and an earlier language, forgetting its roots.
Impressive, Baptiste. You're obviously educated, and obviously very pretty under all that grit and gore on your face. What's not so obvious is how you got here from the Americas.
Does it matter?
Very much. It is the question that consumes Batu, and he is desperate for an answer before the Tushegun arrives.
I think I know what those words mean, at least. It's a title. The Avenging Lama, right?
Tushegun Kurkuere! Tushegun Kurkuere!
Sverdlovsk looked toward the far end of the valley.
Ah, he is ahead of schedule. If he had arrived when he was supposed to, I might have been able to browbeat Batu into placing you in my custody. It is too late for that now, I fear.
Two mounted men approached the bonfire through a path flanked on either side by warriors and their women standing at respectful attention. Flames played off the burnished iron scales of armor, winked from the polished helmets. Though the two men rode abreast, Bridget didn't need Sverdlovsk to point out which figure was the Tushegun. He was a head taller than his saddle mate, though the fanged bear skull mounted on top of his fur-trimmed helmet probably added a few inches to his height. A molded breastplate of leather encased his torso and was reinforced by an interlocking pattern of metal scales. The long sword at his side, its scabbard set with gems, swung in rhythm to his dappled horse's prancing gait. His face was strangely shaped, strangely shadowed, and it wasn't until he reined his mount to a halt that Bridget realized he wore a mask. It was crafted of a thin layer of exquisitely carved jade. At least it looked like jade because of its creamy green hue. The mask covered his face from his hairline to just above his mouth, leaving only the lower lip and chin exposed. The mask held no particular expression, but from behind the curving eyelets glinted an imperious, hawk-like gaze. Sverdlovsk dropped to one knee and stuck out his tongue in the traditional Mongolian greeting and act of submission. The intent, expressionless scrutiny of the masked face was focused not on the Russian, but on Bridget. She tried to return the gaze with the same unblinking intensity.
Mikulskig.
The one word from the Tushegun had an immediate effect. Sverdlovsk instantly sprang to his feet and whirled on Bridget.
Grovel before the Avenging Lama.
Bridget bent double, hanging between the spear hafts, tears of pain clouding her vision, but helping to dissolve more of the dried blood. When she raised her head again, Bautu stood beside the Tushegun's horse, holding up the bundle of ordnance like an offering. The Tushegun poked and picked at the blasters with only a mild interest. He held up the transcom unit and spoke to Bridget. The language he used was Russian.
Does this function?
Answered the Avenging Lama.
I don't know. It may have been damaged when we were set upon.
The Tushegun dropped the transcom to the ground as if it were contaminated. He pricked his horse's flanks with his spurs, and the animal lurched forward, hooves stamping on it. He took the blasters from the bundle, handed one to his companion, and kept the other two, looping the gun belts over his saddle horn.
Tell me at once, woman. Why do you come here?
To explore, to trade. We mean no harm.
How did you get here?
By ship.
From America?
No, from China.
You did not come from the great years. I would have heard about three travelers. I see falsehoods in your eyes, woman.
I see nothing in yours. Take off your mask so I may look into your eyes, and perhaps we will talk.
The masked figure slowly stiffened in the saddle.
A thing is not hidden without reason, woman. Nor is it found without reason. You are here to sap the sacred flame within the Black City. Who sent you?
No one.
I wish only to know that. A fox knows a great many things. A badger knows only one great thing. Who sent you?
Are you the badger or the fox?
The masked man didn't reply to her question. He looked to Sverdlovsk.
Baltu will torture her until she speaks the truth. If she does not, she will feel the kiss of the dragon. You will watch and listen and report to me anything she says.
Wait. You haven't heard everything. We sought only to make trading treaties.
I have heard enough. Your people will come and your treaties will sap our strength and that of the Black City. I swore an oath to Shamos to fulfill our destiny.
Great one. I have brought what you requested. Would you not care to inspect it?
Unload them, bring them to my yurt.
His right hand jabbed toward the far end of the valley, and light glinted briefly from a ring on his gloved index finger. It was a massive ornament, made of thick hammered silver, designed like a dragon coiled in four loops. The horned head was baleful and demonic of expression. The firelight made tiny iridescent sparks dance within the eyes of yellow gemstones. With a slight start of surprise, Bridget realized the configuration of the snarling dragon head corresponded to the mark on Baotu's forehead. It was almost as if the ring had been exposed to a flame and the superheated metal pressed into Baotu's flesh. The Tushigun and his companion turned toward the scattering of yurts. Baotu grinned at Bridget, uncoiling his lash.
Baotu, yet!
The grin vanished from Baotu's face. The warrior hooked the whip onto his belt. He gestured to a pair of men at the bonfire, and they joined him at the rear of the truck. Sverdlovsk tucked his hands back into his pockets, watching the men untying the rope binders around the crates. He spoke to Bridget without looking at her.
A respite, Baptiste, not a reprieve. Now, speak to me, Baptiste, anything, in English. Sound angry.
Russian vodka tastes like stump water!
Sverdlovsk wheeled on her, face contorted in anger. He took his right hand out of his pocket and closed it over her bound left wrist, shaking the spear haft.
Can you make it back to the gateway?
If I had transportation!
The keys are in the wag. God help you if you're recaptured. I'll be howling for your blood just like the rest of those Tatar bastards.
Sverdlovsk removed his hand from her wrist, cuffed her across the face, and spun on his heel, marching toward the men laboring to unload the crates. Bridget watched him go, shouting and gesticulating imperiously.
Thank you! Karl Marx wore women's clothing!
Bridget carefully folded her fingers over the small, open penknife Sverdlovsk had slipped into her palm. She kept her left arm in position, pressed against the spear haft, though she could tell by the burning pins and needles sensation in her hand that circulation was returning to it. Sverdlovsk had sliced through the rawhide thongs. She watched the unloading of the wag and waited through one of the longest minutes of her life. It felt far longer than the minute preceding her march to the execution wall in the bowels of the administrative monolith back in Cobaltville. 3 months separated that minute from this one, and she was separated from her old life in Cobaltville by a distance more immense than mere time. It was still hard to believe the magnitude of change that had taken her from being an archivist, living a very confined, sheltered existence, to an outcast of the Ville Society. And it was through Kane bringing her encoded information that she landed in that predicament. It had to do with resistance to the rule in the Villes and secret information about the nuclear war of 2001 and the later developments. After the last-minute rescue by Kane, fleeing their way of life was the only choice. Together with Grant, Kane's fellow magistrate, and the Outlander girl Domi, they fled beyond the Ville's walls. Just about the only reminder of her former existence was Lakesh at the Project Cerberus Redoubt. He'd been her supervisor, the head archivist, but he'd secretly headed up the resistance movement. To get to that point of revelation, they'd first been pursued in the Outlands, then followed up with the discovery of the matter transfer chamber, the same type of mat-trans jump that landed her in this trouble on the other side of the globe. She continued to stand motionless until she was sure no eye was cast in her direction. Deftly, she brought her left hand away from the spear haft and slashed at the leather thongs around her right wrist. The knife blade was very sharp, and she ignored the fact that she sliced through some skin at the same time. She only prayed she hadn't opened up a major vein or punctured an artery. After the strands of rawhide parted, she placed her left hand back against the pole. The thongs, half buried in the flesh of her wrists, stayed in place and would fool a casual glance. Bautu and the warriors Sverdlovsk had pressed into service walked away from the truck, arms laden with crates. Only a couple were heavy enough to require two men to carry them. When their backs were to her, Bridget made her move. She lowered her arms and carefully stepped back as far as she could from the perimeter of the firelight. She kept her eyes trained on the warriors. Nothing could be done for Adrian and Davis. They hadn't stirred at all since she regained consciousness. Moving in a half-crouch, half-scuttle, she angled her way toward the truck, approaching the driver's door, which faced away from the bonfire. The ground beneath her feet was rocky, patched with snow, and she winced at the slight sound it made when she walked. She didn't pause when she reached a point directly in front of the battered grill of the old wag. Three long, swift steps brought her around it, glad the door window was rolled down.
Hey!
Pivoting on the balls of her feet, Bridget saw a stump-legged man stepping out from between a pair of rock outcroppings. His hands were at his crotch, and she realized he had just relieved himself and couldn't see her clearly in the murk. She did the first thing that occurred to her. She sprang forward and lashed out with her right hand. The knife blade slashed across his broad forehead. Blood flowed down his face into his eyes. With one hand, he tried to clear his vision, and with the other, he groped for the long dagger sheathed at his hip. Bridget kicked him as hard as she could between the legs, hoping to smash his testicle sac against his pelvic bone. She whirled, grabbed the door handle of the cab, and threw it down and flung herself behind the wheel. As Sverdlovsk had said, the key was in the ignition. The wag had a standard transmission, much like the Sandcat back at Cerberus, which Domi had taught her to drive. The letters and numbers on the instrument panel were all in Cyrillic, and though she spoke Russian passably, reading it required a concentration and time she didn't have. Bridget wrestled with the wheel and the foot pedals, trying to upshift without stalling. She couldn't tell by the gauge how much fuel was in the tank, but Sverdlovsk had seemed certain the vehicle would carry her to the gateway. The cab wasn't outfitted with rearview mirrors, so the only way to check her back trail was to roll down the window, twist around, and poke her head out. Bridget saw yard-long arrows fly past the truck. Most were hastily aimed, though she heard at least two hit the bed. The terrain was rocky, and rather than risk breaking an axle, she shifted to a lower gear, fighting the wheel, relying on the waning moon to light her way. Bridget Baptiste didn't need a compass. She possessed an eidetic or photographic memory. The overland route she and her companions had taken from the Matrans installation was indelibly impressed on her mind. Her Kron had been taken, so she had only a vague idea of the time. She knew she was several hours overdue for a transcom check-in. Though Lakesh had instructed Kane and Grant to wait at the installation for 24 hours before commencing a search, she prayed she would meet one or both of them halfway. With each mile, the going became smoother. The ground was still rock-littered, still fissured and cracked, but once out of the valley, the country gave way more and more to sand. Turning on the headlights, she avoided the deeper drifts as best she could, fearing the tires would bog down in the dunes. Though the wag couldn't have been traveling at more than 30 miles per hour, the shock of the cold wind made her shiver violently. Her insulated clothing was torn and ragged, so hypothermia was a real possibility. The plains stretched bleak and empty behind her, but she knew pursuit lay out there. Fuel was the only thing that kept the pursuit from being close. She, Adrian, and Davis hadn't been concerned with making time during their journey from the installation, but they had still been out in this stretch of the Gobi for 8 hours before their capture. She tried to calculate how long it would take the wag to cover the same distance, and her best estimate was an hour, probably a little more than that, assuming she maintained the present rate of speed. The adrenaline in her system ebbed, and she felt exhaustion overtake her. Her body, muscles pulled and beaten, throbbed with pain. She found her mind straining for clarity, trying to push away the wispy folds of inertia, of weariness. She gripped the steering wheel tightly, deliberately averting her gaze from the angry red abrasions encircling her slim wrists. The landscape once again became rugged, scattered with rock formations sprouting from the sand. She was concerned about her constantly aching head and frequent blurring of her vision. Knowing she had to keep alert, she welcomed the chilly chafe of the wind, but feared its effects on her body temperature. Then she saw it, the dark bulk of a rocky hill only a mile ahead.
Oh, thank God. Oh, shit.
The vehicle rolled onward, its momentum carrying it across the sandy soil even as its speed dropped. Gently, it slid to a complete stop. She knew there was no point in trying to restart the truck. The fuel was gone. She climbed out of the cab, hugging herself, trying to rub warmth back into her limbs. She looked back the way she had come. Strung out across the horizon were six black shapes bounding over the barren sandscape. The shapes were warriors astride their sturdy little horses. The riders had to have been pushing the animals to their very limits to be within her range of vision. She estimated they would be upon her in less than half an hour. Quickly, Bridget eyed the distant hill and then the sky. The sun would soon be flooding the Gobi with its lambent light, and if she couldn't reach the installation before then, she would never see another dawn. Refusing to dwell upon that possibility, Bridget started running. Her booted feet churned up the sand, and she knew she was leaving a trail a blind drag could follow, but it couldn't be helped. She ran toward the ridge with a steady lightness and sureness of stride that came of long practice. Bridget kept looking toward the sky for any sign of the rising sun. Within moments, the light of Sol peeped over the rim of the world, staining the blue-black backdrop of sky with a halo of crimson. She continued running. Pain stitched along her left side. The muscles of her legs felt as if they were caught in a vise, and her vision was shot through with gray specks. The skin between her shoulder blades crawled in anticipation of one of the warrior's long arrows planting its barbed head there. She altered direction, heading for the tumble of basalt at the foot of the hill. She knew she wouldn't get to it before the tribesmen reached her. She hazarded one quick glance behind her. Unsurprisingly, the mounted men were gaining. Despite the dim light, she recognized Bao Tu in the lead, leaning over his horse's neck, teeth bared in a ferocious grin. Bridget ran across the stone-strewed ground, her feet slipping on the rocks. She dodged among the larger chunks of basalt and granite, banging her knees. She looked over her shoulder. Bao Tu charged forward, his whip inscribing a hazy circle in the air over his head. His mount galloped at a frightful, reckless speed, hooves kicking up bucketfuls of sand and pebbles. The whip snaked around Bridget's throat, a streak of fire across her chin and neck. Bridget clawed at it, staggering as Bao Tu galloped past, intending to pull her off her feet and drag her behind his mount. As the length of oiled braided leather stretched taut, Bridget didn't resist the pull. She went with it, kicking herself forward, the penknife gripped in her right fist. Bao Tu glimpsed what she was doing and fumblingly tried to transfer the whip from his right to his left hand, seeking to draw his sword. He dropped the reins in the process, twisting on his wooden saddle as Bridget sprang at him. She sank the blade of the knife into the horse's rump up to the hilt. The animal exploded forward, rearing and bucking at the same time. Bao Tu released the whip, grabbing the horse's mane. The flank of the animal slammed into her, bowling her off her feet. Already off balance because of the horse's wild bounding gyrations, Bao Tu tipped from the saddle and fell heavily and gracelessly to the ground. The other riders rushed by, unsheathing their swords, then wheeled their mounts expertly around. Bridget bounded to her feet quickly, and realizing they had cut off her escape route, began to run in the opposite direction. Bao Tu staggered erect, dragging his sword from its scabbard. His eyes were wide and crazed with kill light.
Baptiste, down!
Without an instant's hesitation, Bridget flung herself to the stone-littered ground. Scarlet bloomed on the right side of Bao Tu's head. Limply, he toppled backward to the sand. The crashing impact of the Sin Eater's 248-grain bullet slapped two warriors from their saddles, their arms and legs flopping bonelessly. Unable to rein their mounts down, two of the riders were thrown, one warrior falling beneath sharp, stamping hooves. Bridget saw the surviving warriors gazing into the pre-dawn dimness beyond her. Their eyes were wide, and their mouths gaped open. From a wedge of shadow between a pair of upthrusts of rock marched two black figures. They were like statues sculpted from obsidian, somehow given life and movement. The fading starlight struck dim highlights on the molded chest pieces and shoulder pads. Their faces were completely concealed by black helmets, except for their mouths and chins. Red-tinted visors masked their eyes. Both armored figures carried autoblasters in their right hands. Their tread was measured, deliberate, and menacing. One of the warriors unlimbered his bow, knocked an arrow, drew back, and released a feathered shaft. The arrow struck the larger of the black figures squarely on a molded pectoral. The arrow bounced away.
Why, you dirty little prick.
The Sin-Eater in his hand spit flame, and the bowman catapulted backward from a devastating center punch through the breastbone, which not only pulverized his lungs, but smashed his spinal column to fragments. The surviving warrior rushed headlong into the desert, following the already vanishing horses.
Alvin! Alvin!
Had Bridget understood his tongue, she would have known he was shouting the word for demon. She tried to stand, but she swayed and decided to stay on her knees. She was uncoiling the lash from around her neck when Kane crouched down beside her and touched her face with gloved fingers.
You're a mess, Baptiste.
This hairbreadth escape stuff has got to stop.
Kane helped her to her feet, one polycarbonate-encased arm around her waist. She leaned into him gratefully, sagging in exhaustion. Tension drained out of her, leaving her weak and watery-kneed. Grant stepped over to the fallen Bautu, nudging his ribs with the steel-reinforced toe of a boot. He eyed the blood-soaked face.
Shit. Just grazed the bastard. Thought I'd shot straighter than that.
Straight enough for me.
Where are Davis and Adrian?
Dead. That animal there that Grant grazed is Bautu. He chilled them by half inches.
Grant pointed the blunt barrel of his Sin-Eater at the wounded man's head.
Time to rectify my lousy marksmanship, then.
Don't. We didn't learn anything except the warlord's name. Not even that, actually. Just his title. The Tushegun.
The Tushegun? What kind of dumbass title is that?
It means the Avenging Llama.
What about his tech and firepower? Pretty dark?
Not from what I saw. But he's getting some kind of material from the Russians. Or one Russian, anyway. A man named Sverdlovsk. He wore a silver disc badge, and he knew about the gateway.
An officer of their internal security network. Back in our magistrate days, Grant and I were briefed about them. They supposedly had a base on Kamchatka Peninsula, up around Alaska a few years ago. If it's the same briefing I remember, that intel was pretty damn old. Like 80 or 90 years. That won't meet my definition of a few. 80 years or a few, the rat bastards are still fucking around in other people's countries.
We weren't exactly on a bird-watching junket, remember?
Bautu stirred. Blood had trickled into the corner of his mouth, and red bubbles formed on his lips. His eyelids fluttered.
This one's our only solid source of intel. Maybe Lakesh can understand his dialect. Do either of you have anything to keep him under until we get back to Cerberus?
I do.
Okay, that works.
Grasping the man by his wrists, Grant heaved him up and rolled him over the wide brace of his shoulders. Bautu's head hung down, blood crawling along the length of his braids, dripping sluggishly to the gravel-spotted sand.
Let's go. Getting cold out here.
Kane and Bridget followed him. Though she felt a bit stronger, she didn't object to Kane's armored arm around her waist.
We were just on our way to track you. Good thing you arrived when you did. I hate hikes.
Saved us both a lot of inconvenience.
Avoiding inconvenience is the only part of the magistrate oath I still practice, Baptiste.
They wended their way through the boulders and upthrusts of basalt until they reached the base of what appeared to be a heap of sand, decorated with scraggly vegetation. Kane released Bridget and moved lithely forward, ahead of Grant and his unconscious burden. From a pelt pouch, she removed a small plastic oval, pulled a thread-thin antenna from it, and pointed it at the sandhill. Instantly, a section of the hill collapsed in upon itself, and the entrance door to the gateway installation irised open. Dim light spilled out. Kane led the way past the portal and down a short flight of metal stairs. Bridget brought up the rear, waiting until Grant and Bautu were at the bottom of the stairs before pulling down on the wall lever to close the sec door and reseal the gateway installation. The gateways were major aspects of the pre-dark scientific project known as the totality concept. Gateway was the colloquial term for a quantum interface transducer, otherwise referred to as a MAT-trans unit. Most of the units were buried in subterranean military complexes known as redoubts in the United States. Only a handful of people knew they even existed, and only half a handful knew all their locations. The knowledge had been lost after the nuke cost, rediscovered a century later, then jealously, ruthlessly guarded. There were, however, units in other countries, among them Japan, England, Canada, and this one in Mongolia. The installation wasn't a redoubt. In pre-dark days, this region of the Black Gobi had served as China's principal nuclear and weapons testing site, so its presence was not unusual. However, the exact purpose of the units and of the totality concept itself had vanished when the ultimate nuclear holocaust had destroyed civilization all over the world. When Bridget reached the foot of the stairs, she joined Kane and Grant in the Mattrans chamber. Unlike the layout of most other redoubts, this little installation had no adjacent control or recovery room. It held only the six-walled jump chamber, its translucent armorglass walls colored a rich amber. The floor consisted of a hexagonal interlocking pattern of raised metal discs. The same pattern was duplicated in the ceiling. Grant dumped Bao-Tu unceremoniously on the floor.
Son of a bitch is heavier than he looks. He stinks, too.
Kane undid the chin lock on his helmet and pulled it up and off his head. His dark brown hair was damp with perspiration. Grant removed his own helmet and wiped at the pebbles of sweat shining on his coffee-colored skin. He was a few years older than Kane, a few inches taller and more than a few pounds heavier. His heavy-jawed face was set in a perpetual scowl. Bridget had learned that the more Grant frowned, the more satisfied with circumstances he felt. The sprinkling of gray in his black hair gave him a patrician air, like somebody's curmudgeonly but essentially good-hearted uncle. In contrast, Kane's high-planed face always mirrored his emotions. His piercing eyes were gray, with enough blue in them so the color resembled the high sky at sunset. The alert, wary look in them never changed. But Bridget had seen his face transformed into something ugly and terrible by rage, and then changed to the epitome of warm humor on those rare occasions when he laughed. It was difficult to keep in mind that Grant and Kane had spent their entire adult lives as killers, superbly trained and conditioned magistrates, not only bearing the legal license to deal death, but the spiritual sanction as well. Although she owed both men her life, she still feared them.
Lockish's judgment was fused out on this one.
I'm the only archivist and historian at Cerberus. I thought I could speak the language, so his judgment was sound. If he'd sent you and Grant, all we'd have to show for the mission would be a wagload of dead Mongols.
Adrian and Davis would still be alive.
Tears suddenly stung Bridget's eyes and she turned away.
Let's make the jump.
By the metal handle affixed to the center of the armorglass, Kane sealed the chamber. The automatic transit process began. All of them understood, in theory, that the Mattrans units required a dizzying number of maddeningly intricate electronic procedures, all occurring within milliseconds of one another to minimize the margins for error. The actual conversion process was automated for this reason, sequenced by an array of computers and microprocessors. Though they accepted at face value that the machines worked, it still seemed like magic to them. The disks above and below them exuded a silvery glow, and wraiths of white mist formed on the ceiling and floor. Tiny static discharges like miniature lightning bolts flared in the vapor. Though Kane didn't sleep, he dreamed. He dreamed of the world's past, the nuclear war that had created the Deathlands, the remains of the USA, unrecognizable to any who'd lived there before the nuke cost. Then, slowly, out of barbarism and anarchy, a new system came into being, bringing technology into its fortified cities and a predetermined, strict way of life for its citizens. What lay beyond the well-policed villes was now called the Outlands. Kane's family was devoted to the duties of magistrates, those charged with enforcing the rules in the enclaves and in the still ruinous and wild Outlands. The populations of the villes, and to some extent the surrounding Outlands, cooperated with this tyranny because of a justified fear and guilt nourished by the new doctrine. For the past 80 years, it had been bred into the people that Judgment Day had arrived and humanity had been rightly punished. The doctrines expressed in Ville teachings encouraged humanity to endure continual punishment before a utopian age could be ushered in. Because humanity had ruined the world, the punishment was deserved. The doctrines ultimately amounted to extortion: obey and suffer, or disobey and die. The dogma was elegant in its simplicity, and for most of his life, Kane had believed it, had dedicated his life to serving it. Then he stumbled over a few troubling questions, and when he attempted to find the answers, all he discovered were many troubling questions, and the fact that humans were becoming little more than slaves. What had become the most important question, the guiding mystery in his life, was to unravel the murky past and see where the future was headed, see it in time to avert some dread calamity. Pigs, geese, and cattle. First, find out that they are owned. Then find out the whyness of it. That bit of ancient doggerel drove Cain, Bridget, and Grant forward, kept them from accepting or surrendering to the forces arrayed against them. It had turned them into exiles on the planet of their birth. Pigs, geese, and cattle. The Nukost and the Barons had reduced humanity to the status of barnyard animals. First, find out that they are owned. Certain dark forces were utterly devoted to keeping the yoke of slavery around the collective necks of humanity, to keep them in the barnyard and troop willingly to the slaughterhouse. Then find out the whyness of it. Cain opened his eyes. All he saw were armaglass walls. These were brown, not amber, so he knew the jump was successful. He had made only a few gateway transits in the past 3 months, so he was always pleasantly surprised when he realized he was still alive and whole. Intellectually, he knew the Mad-Trans energies transformed organic and inorganic matter to digital information, transmitted it through a hyperdimensional quantum path, and reassembled it in a receiver unit. Emotionally, the experience felt like a fleeting brush with death, or worse than death. It was non-existence, at least for a nanosecond. Grant and Bridget stirred on the floor plates. Bautu lay where he had been dropped. One of the most baffling features of Mattran's jumps was how a subject could start it standing up and end it by lying flat on his back. The first jump they had made from Colorado to Montana had been marked by nausea, vertigo, and headaches, all symptoms of jump sickness. Lakesh had explained that the ill effects were due to the modulation frequency of the carrier wave interfacing with individual metabolisms. It had since been adjusted and refined, but Cain wondered how the few hardy souls who had used the devices after Skydark could have tolerated the adverse physical results. Climbing to his feet, gritting his teeth against a brief wave of dizziness, Cain moved over to Bridget, who had both hands pressed against her head.
Important health tip, gentlemen. Don't jump if you've already got a headache.
The heavy door of the chamber swung open and allowed DeFore and one of her medics to enter. DeFore was a buxom, stocky woman with deep bronze skin and ash-blonde hair braided at the back of her neck. Her aide's name was Auerbach, a burly, freckled man with a red buzz cut. Following the SEC protocols, he carried an SA-80 subgun. Both people wore white, form-fitting bodysuits, the standard duty uniform of the Cerberus Redoubt. DeFore's eyes swept around the chamber and settled on Bridget.
Where are Davis and Adrian?
They didn't make it.
Is this lovely unconscious specimen a prisoner or a guest?
He's a prisoner. His name is Bautu.
Both you and he need medical attention. Auerbach, call for Gurney. Grant, Cain, you know the drill.
Helmets under their arms, Grant and Cain walked out of the Mattran's chamber through a small recovery anteroom and into the control center of the Cerberus Redoubt. The room was long, with high, vaulted ceilings. Consoles of dials, switches, buttons, and lights flickering red, green, and yellow ran the length of the walls. Needles twitched, and monitor screens displayed changing columns of numbers. Kata and Wegman were on duty at the Environops station, and they gave Cain and Grant nervous nods as they passed by. Grant glanced at the big Mercator relief map of the world that spanned nearly one entire wall. Spots of light flickered on almost every continent, and thin, glowing lines networked across the countries, like a web spun by a radioactive spider. The map delineated all the geophysical alterations caused by the Nukost and pinpointed the locations of functioning gateway units all over the world. The two men stepped out into a wide, arched corridor made of softly gleaming vanadium alloy. Great curving ribs of metal and massive girders supported the high rock roof. The Cerberus Redoubt was built into the side of a Montana mountain peak and could be reached from the outside only by a single, treacherous road. The sector was usually closed, so the gateway brought people and materials in and out. The tri-level 30-acre facility had come through the nuke cost in fairly good shape. It and most of the other redoubts had been built according to specifications for maximum impenetrability, short of a direct hit. Its radiation shielding was still intact. The redoubt held 24 self-contained apartments, as well as a frightfully well-equipped armory, a dormitory, and a small dining hall. Cerberus was powered by nuclear generators and probably would continue to be for at least another 500 years. The installation had served as the seat of Project Cerberus, a subdivision of Overproject Whisper, which in turn had been a primary component of the totality concept. Kane had often tried to picture what the place had been like before the nukes flew, bustling with activity, purpose, and people. Now it was full of hollow corridors, empty rooms, and sepulchral silences. The only evidence that it had ever been occupied before Lakesh and his staff of exiles had come to roost was the illustration near the main sector. Emblazoned on one wall was a large, garishly colored image of a froth-mouthed black hound. Three stylized heads grew out of a single, exaggeratedly muscled neck, their jaws spewing flame and blood between great fangs. Below the image, rendered in an absurdly ornate Gothic script, was the word Cerberus. Even Kane, with his narrow education, knew the legend of Cerberus, the ferocious guardian of the gateway to Hades, the netherworld of the dead, to the peoples of ancient Greece. It seemed an appropriate totem and code name for the project devoted to ripping open gates in the quantum field. Grant and Kane turned into the last door on the left. It opened up onto a wide, white-tiled shower room. Each stall was enclosed by shoulder-high partitions. Rad counter gauges were affixed to the walls beneath the shower heads. They stepped into individual stalls, stripped off their body armor, and piled it beneath the shower heads. The rad counters displayed only tepid yellow readings, not even 100 wrenchins, but they decided to scrub up all the same. Symptoms of rad sickness sometimes took days to appear. If the area they had just jumped from had ever been hot, the rad level had fallen dramatically over the years. One of the mysteries spawned by the nuke cost was how hell zones could coexist cheek to jowl with clean regions. Reportedly, much of Asia had been all but obliterated during the day-long nuclear conflict, and coastal areas were swallowed by tsunamis, giant tidal waves triggered by Russian Earthshaker bombs. Then again, much of what they had been taught about the nuke cost had turned out to be lies, so it was possible the devastation had been somewhat exaggerated, so humanity wouldn't wonder if anything better lay over the horizon. A mixture of warm liquid disinfectant and sterilizing fluid sprayed from the nozzle. Kane worked the decam stream into a lather and massaged it into his scalp and all over his body. When the needle of the rad counter leaned over into the far edge of the green zone, a jet of cold, clear water gushed down and rinsed him and his armor off. After the decam process, Kane and Grant slipped into white bodysuits handed to them by an attendant. They always felt a bit naked without the sin-eaters strapped to their forearms, but their old habits had to be discarded here in Cerberus. Both of them had to continually remind themselves they were no longer magistrates, enforcing the many and contradictory laws of Baron Cobalt. They were exiles now, as were all the personnel of Cerberus, except for one, and Kane wasn't sure if that particular one qualified as a person. The dispensary adjoined DCAM, and when they entered, they saw Bautu stretched out on an examination table, bound by canvas restraints. He was still unconscious, and DeFore was attaching gleaming electrodes to his shaved scalp. His head wound had been cleaned and treated by a liquid bandage. A film like a thin layer of skin had been sprayed over the bullet graze. The film contained nutrients and antibiotics, and the body absorbed it as the injury healed. Brigid sat on the edge of a bed on the far side of the room. She had changed into a bodysuit that clung in all the right places to her tall, willowy figure. Her heavy mounds of reddish-gold hair were tied back. The dried blood had already been sponged from her smoothly sculpted face, revealing a faint rosy complexion and a light dusting of freckles across her nose and cheeks. Her eyes weren't just green, they were a deep, clear, glittering emerald. Auerbach examined the cut on her right temple. He used an aerosol can to apply the liquid bandage. Kane focused his attention on DeFore and Bautu. She plugged the electrode leads into a wheeled diagnostic scanner at the head of the bed and turned it on. Kane could make nothing of the flashing lights or the erratic jumping of a green line. Brigid rose from the bed and came over, touching the patch of thin film on the side of her head. Her bright eyes regarded the display monitor curiously.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the electroencephalogram seems unusually, unusual for a Homo sapiens.
So, you're a doctor on top of being a historian. I'm impressed.
Reprimand accepted, Doctor. And now tell me...
Yes, Baptiste. The readings are unusual. It appears the transmitter molecules released by the axonic end fibers of the brain's neurons aren't all crossing the synapse. The ascending and descending neuron fibers aren't decussating normally. There seems to be a cross-current block, which may explain the patient's hypnopompic state of consciousness, evidence of some kind of brain damage.
Funny thing. Being shot in the head will do that to a man.
Except for a mild concussion, he's physically sound. The bullet didn't even crack the cranial casing. No, if it's brain damage, it's a strangely localized pattern.
Explain.
If you'll let me conduct a thorough examination, I'll try.
Allow the medics to attend to medical matters, friend Kane.
Kane turned as Lakesh entered. A wrinkled cadaver of a man, he was old, far older than he looked, and he looked very old indeed. His thin gray hair was cropped so short it was barely a patina of ash on his head. The network of deep seams and creases on his leathery face bespoke the anguish of keeping 2 centuries' worth of secrets. He wore a pair of spectacles with a hearing aid attached to the right earpiece. His eyes were a cloudy, watery blue. Domi stood at his side, one arm slipped through his. She was a white wraith of a girl, with a provocative flare of hips. Her skin wasn't pale, but bone white, with no hint of pink, as if she were crafted from flawless porcelain. Her white hair was cut short and untidy and framed an angular, hollow-cheeked face. She wore a skin-tight belted jerkin of a silken red material that not only accentuated the ruby hue of her big eyes, but showed off her long, slim legs to full advantage. Like Baptiste, Grant, and himself, Domi was another exile from Cobaltville. Unlike them, she was not Ville-bred, but had been born in the Outlands, where post-Nukost conditions had resulted in her type of albinism. Circumstances had thrown her in with the others, but she was not bound to them. She wasn't classified as a renegade or as a traitor to Baron Cobalt, nor did she have an active termination warrant hanging over her. As an outlander, an outrunner, she was free to leave the redoubt at any time. So far, Domi had shown no inclination to do so. Despite the narrow strictures of life at Cerberus, it was still a much softer, safer existence than what she had known either in the Outlands or in the pits of Cobaltville. Besides, Lakesh had a peculiar fondness for her, due either to her rather endearing quality of innocence or her equally endearing habit of dressing provocatively. Domi cast Grant a wide smile. Kane noted ruefully that Grant's return smile was a nervous twitch of the lips. Whereas Lakesh seemed unusually fond of the half-feral girl, Domi appeared to dote on Grant. She saw Grant as her rescuer from sexual slavery to Cobaltville pit boss Guana Teague. In fact, she had saved Grant's life as he was being strangled by Teague. They had helped each other successfully escape from Cobaltville, so their bond was understandable. Though Grant had no idea of Domi's age, it was fairly obvious he was old enough to be her father. He avoided being alone with her as much as possible. Kane wasn't sure if Grant distrusted Domi or himself. Probably a combination.
I am truly sorry how cruelly you were treated, dearest Bridget. I can only hope your travails were worth it.
Afraid not. The dialect the tribesmen spoke was incomprehensible. All I learned was that the rumors of a Mongolian warlord have foundation. Whether he has pre-dark tech at his disposal is still an open question.
Tell me what happened.
Lakesh doddered over and lowered himself into a chair. In a terse, colorless tone, Bridget told him everything that happened upon leaving the Gateway installation and setting out across the Gobi. Her voice shook slightly when she reported how Adrian and Davis died.
If it wasn't for Sverdlovsk, I would have died the same way, too.
What do you mean?
He helped me to escape.
We lost 2 people, and you made a friend and brought another one home to visit. Of course, since nobody speaks his language, and according to the doctor, he's brain damaged, all he'll do is take up bed space.
Enough, Kane.
It's not nearly enough, old man. You decide where to act on rumors about a self-styled warlord a world away. These rumors were probably a year old and distorted beyond reality by the time they filtered into Cobaltville. Before my exile, I was told by Selvo himself the rumors were just that. In the Mag Division, we always heard rumors. We learned not to put much faith in talk. Why do you?
Because I have access to intelligence your former fraternity did not have. What upsets you about this the most, Kane? The loss of personnel?
Partly. It was a waste of resources. And you put Baptiste at risk.
I volunteered, Kane. I wasn't ordered.
That makes it worse. Our numbers are small enough as it is. Now we're down to 10. Academics should not go out into the field until the field is secured.
You are applying Magistrate Division protocols to a completely different set of situations, my friend. At any rate, it should be possible to wring some answers from our guest, brain damaged or not. We can hook him up to a language interpretation program. The words won't be exact translations due to his dialect, but the computer will recognize enough of his words to supply an English equivalent.
What if he's feeling uncommunicative when he wakes up?
That's why we have a supply of pentothal and other psychotropics.
With Domi's help, Lakesh heaved himself out of the chair.
Now, I suggest you all accompany me to the control center.
Me too?
Of course, darlingest one. We can't make a move without your valuable input, you know that.
Lakesh patted her arm with a gnarled hand. Kane rolled his eyes.
Brigid, do you feel strong enough to join us?
Certainly. Why?
I owe you all a look at what I fear we may be dealing with.